Scott Williams is going to talk to me right now about Scott Walker and the song of the one all alone. Scott, good afternoon and welcome to the program.
Hi, Joe. Yeah, Scott Wilson, actually.
What did I say?
Williams.
Oh, I know Scott Williams. That's why. Sorry. I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon, Scott Wilson.
Scott Wilson on Scott Walker.
Oh, yeah. When I saw it, I thought, there's a misprint here somewhere along the line. Scott, you're a professor of media and psychoanalysis at Kingston University in London.
Yes, I do a bit of the psychoanalysis, but the main thing is, I work at Kingston. I work in the Department of Journalism, Publishing and Media. And I work closely with colleagues in the music department, where we have one of the largest analog studios in London called the Visconti Studio, which has been partly developed by Tony Visconti and is named after him.
Mm.
So we have a kind of specialism in popular music.
So talk to me about Scott Walker and what has preempted this particular song of the one all alone.
Hmm. Okay, well, Scott Walker, as you know, has had a marvelous career, really interesting career, going from a pop idol in the 1960s to sort of end up as a really interesting avant-garde artist. Someone said once that it's like Andy Williams ending up at Stockhausen. So it's a really interesting phenomenon, and I would have thought it deserved a sort of book-length scrutiny. The sort of scrutiny that you'd give to an artist and a poet. So, and I also got the opportunity because Bloomsbury, the publisher, has this series called Eccentrics that focuses on non-mainstream artists, and I suggested to them that Scott Walker would be a good subject, and they said yes, so they were interested in doing that.
And so what do you do in this? Do you look at the character, and do you look at the music that he wrote and presented?
Yes, I look at the music and the lyrics, and I give close scrutiny and interpretations of some of his best songs, both from the 60s but also more latterly. It does have a particular theme, as the subtitle suggests. It focuses on solitude, aloneness, and loneliness. That's one of the central themes of his work, but also, obviously, of the book that follows that up. Sort of solitude, both positively and negatively. So from the social loneliness of abandoned lovers, spinsters like Rosemary or Big Louise, the lonely transsexual, these figures and characters that he brought to life in the 1960s, to the more paranoid dictators and despots of the later works. Also, at the same time, there's the solitude necessary to artistic reflection that was very important to Scott Walker himself in his creation of a very singular work, and even a spiritual sovereignty that Walker sings out about in his last works. There's this really remarkable long 22-minute song off of one of his last albums, Bish Bosh, about a brown dwarf called Zircon, who entertained Attila the Hun in his court. And then he escapes this place in order to become a variety of things, including a flagpole sitter, ultimately to turn into a different kind of brown dwarf, an astral body that floats in deep space. It's kind of an allegory of Scott Walker's career himself, as he goes from a popular entertainer into something that's much more remote and exists in his own sound world of darkness.
So did Scott Walker start out like this, with that mentality when he started?
Yes, he did. I mean, there's a famous quotation on the back of the second Walker Brothers album, which says, Scott is an existentialist and who's read Jean-Paul Sartre and knows what it means. And he, this course of obviously a lot of raised eyebrows and a few sneers at the time, but he really was somebody who's committed to that approach, and it informs the ethic, really, of his life and work. So, yeah, the book does look at his relationship to existentialism and how his work more latterly develops that and engages with it in his own way. So, yes, something I found very interesting, and it gives a sort of academic dimension to the book, but it's not entirely that.
And listening to his music when it was playing on the radio, when it was popular, when the Walker Brothers were at their height, How many people would have understood what he was trying to do or what he was doing? You know, just listening to it in the kitchen back in the 60s or the 70s, was it obvious what he was doing?
I think at the level of feeling, it was. If you think of one of the most famous Walker Brothers songs, you know, "The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore."
Yeah.
It says, "Loneliness, you know, is the cloak you wear. Emptiness is the space you're in." And the way that he sings it, his remarkable voice, as people have said, it's not just a song of you know, lost love. It's also kind of existential anguish when he sings, "You're all alone." You know, as yes. it goes on. So I think at the level of, you know, a fact as it hits you in the body, it does get across that he's moving from a sort of love song or a song of loss to something that's a bit more deeper and a bit more profound about you know, the solitude of existential being, as it were.
And how did that affect his relationship with his brother?
His brother?
Well, he's, you know, the whole lot. In
oh, they weren't brothers.
Well, I know that, but his brother in terms of being together.
Oh, the rest of the group, John, Mouse and Gary Leeds. Yeah, it's one of the funny things about them. Neither, they weren't brothers, and they weren't called Walker either.
Yes,
Walker
yes.
Got Engel, but yes, how did it affect them? I think they were a bit bemused by it and weren't terribly interested. They're more interested in doing what everyone else does in a band that is being screamed at by loads of fans. They're interested in
just making music and enjoying it and having a good time.
Yeah, they exactly. And I think it Scott Walker's own frustration with that led to the breakup of the group in the mid-60s, 1966. And that's when he started writing his own songs.
I mean,
for the most part, the Walker Brothers did covers, although he did start to do Scott started to do his own songs in some of the albums, but there are only a few. But he starts to do that in the famous Phillips albums of, you know, Scott 1, Scott 2, Scott 3, Scott 4.
Mm.
They had a prom 2 years ago in London dedicated to those works.
Okay.
They're having a bit of a sort of fashionable sort of...
a resurgence.
...moment. Now, yeah, resurgence. Yeah.
Yeah. And did he suffer much with this as he went on in life? Because when he was making the music and when they were together, life would have been going in one particular direction. But then when the band broke up and when the brothers, as we'll call them, were all gone, did he suffer?
Yeah. There are a couple of instances of that. First of all, I mean, I think that sort of fame gets you down anyway when you're in the middle of it. I mean, John Lennon famously wrote Help in the middle of Beatlemania because mm-hmm. he was so distressed about it. And Scott Walker was the same. And I think, you know, there are sort of stories of a suicide attempt. He also ran away to a monastery in the Isle of Wight called Cor Abbey, where he went to study Gregorian chant. But his legion of girl fans chased him out. The monks
really?
told him to get lost because they couldn't bear the noise. So he was kind of chased around. And then after the last of his solo albums in the 60s failed, he went into his sort of bad faith years and did a lot of imbibing, as he said.
Right.
And Walker Brothers got together again in the mid-70s, had a hit with No Regrets, but then that fizzled out. And he got a chance because of their last album to do another solo album in the early 80s for Virgin Records called Climate of Hunter. But that's the lowest selling Virgin record ever.
Really?
So after that, then he kind of lost his way again. I think he went to art college for a while. And there's stories of him sitting in pubs watching blokes play darts, just being on his own. He liked being on his own.
I remember... go ahead.
I think the story goes because of the success of Dusty Springfield with the Pet Shop Boys, somebody thought, we can revitalize the 60s artist, and he got the opportunity to do another record called Tilt, and that came out in 1995, and that really blew everyone's minds. It was so different, so unique, so remarkable, and it was a huge critical success, if not commercially. And he never looked back from that point on, really, having completely refashioned himself as a different kind of artist. He got a different audience. He got huge respect. Oddly, it's really kind of, sadly, at the end of his life, he was busier than ever. He's writing film scores. He just finished one for Brady Corbett's Vox Lux. He was doing all sorts of work. He was working on another another album. He just published a book of his lyrics as poetry, and so he's extremely busy. So it was a real shame. After having, throughout his life, long periods in which he did nothing.
And what brought you to suggest that Scott would be a good topic to explore? Where did your interest come from?
Well, I think that his work is great. I think it is up there with the best art and poetry and music. I think he's developed a completely different idea of what a song is or can be. And so in some ways he transcends the sort of usual studies on pop that focus on subcultures and fan cultures, or even just the sort of thing that talks about, I like this song and, you know, this I identify with it. Something that attempts to give it a bit more, I don't know, serious reflection or critical reflection. So that's what I wanted to do anyway and tried to do.
And is there any fear that in interpreting music that was written 40, 50 years ago, that maybe we're reading too much into it?
Yes, there is a danger of that, which is why you have to limit it in some way. So in my case, I'm looking at those works at the time that clearly bear some relationship to what he was reading at the time, which is on record, and his interest in existentialism. So it's not just what I feel about it.
Sure.
You know, it's not what I just make of it. I try and limit it to a particular theme, like the Song of the One All Alone, and a particular philosophical tradition. And the series of, you know, films he was watching that appear in the songs, and the political events that the songs reference, and so on. So it's always tied to specific things that you can clearly document are connected to the songs in some way. So it's not,
No, I wasn't suggesting that it was just your opinion on it. When I asked that question, I was thinking about things like the dissection that has gone on since 1975 of Bohemian Rhapsody. And I remember seeing a program where academics were locked into a hall, not in even a room, it was a hall. And they were, you know, each trying to figure out what every single word meant and why it was there. And that was kind of the basis of the question. Is sometimes it's just as simple as a song.
You know, it can end up being, you know, strange, you know, a bit delusional and stuff, but it keeps academics busy. That's good. It keeps them off the streets.
It does.
I mean, that's what James Joyce said about Finnegan's Wake, wasn't he? He wanted to keep academics busy for 300 years.
That's right, so, he did. He didn't realize it was going to cause such a fuss, though, I would imagine.
Or maybe he did.
Maybe he did. Yeah. All righty. Who else have you studied in depth like this?
I've never done a single person in depth. I have written a lot about music and avant-garde music. I've written about Brian Eno, Yoko Ono, and I did a little book on black metal and ecology.
Right.
And I've written on rap and things like this. But I've always wanted to do a book on a single artist. And so this was a great opportunity for me.
What's your type of music then? What are you into?
I'm into Scott Walker.
All right. So can you actually listen to Scott Walker and the Walker Brothers and enjoy it? Or do you have to analyze it?
Of course.
Can you?
Of course.
Yeah,
absolutely. I enjoyed the Walker Brothers and I enjoyed the solo albums. Obviously, you know, one has one's favorites. But I also like the ones that are now regarded as, or many people regard as, unlistenable.
Some of them.
Because I've put the time in.
That's
what you need to do. He does, the later work does demand that you sort of put the same sort of commitment in it that he does, which is not everyone can, you know.
All right. Okay, look, well, Scott, it's been fascinating talking to you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Not at all, and that's absolutely fine. And I presume it is available in all good bookstores and on Amazon and various places like
that. Not yet. It's available to pre-order in Amazon and on the Bloomsbury website, but it's not out until October.
Okay, and I'm sure we will be adding that to our TRE bookstore at tre.radio at the time. Listen, I wish you every success with it. And again, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, Scott. Bye-bye.